clearly there are certain stories that always impact on the human condition in many ways. And the notion of the way in which the British Heart Foundation taps into the vital work that it's actually doing can never be underestimated. To address this and put together a whole range of other fascinating inputs into the whole thing, we're delighted to welcome senior cardiac nurse from the British Heart Foundation. That, of course, would be the legendary Maureen Talbot. How are you, Maureen?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
Brilliant. Now, one of the sort of headlines about this particular piece, 85 children born with heart defects in the United Kingdom every week, 4,000 children with congenital heart defects starting school, obviously, next week. Clearly, more research is needed.
Absolutely, more research is needed. But on the plus side, a lot of research has been done over the last 30 years anyway. So in the past, 80% of children didn't actually make it to school if they had a congenital heart defect. And now over 80% do. So as much as it's a positive story, we can always do with more money and more research to find out more about this condition.
Absolutely. CHD or congenital heart disease.
Yeah.
Often children born with this particular condition can have had two operations by the age of 14. And researchers shown that the greater the number of cardiac interventions a child has with CHD, the more medication they take, the greater the negative impact on quality of life. Fairly self-evident, because obviously if you're dealing with invasive surgery all the time, it's problematic in terms of what is that doing to the psychology of the child.
Absolutely, and not only to the child but to the family as well. Sometimes it's harder for the parents than for the child. If a child's feeling well, they'll run around and just live their life, but obviously the parents will be keen to wrap a child up in cotton wool, which isn't always what the child wants. So it's something that we're keen to find out a lot more about, particularly the diagnostic tests, just to make things easier for the child. And also because of the nature of maybe having to have more than one operation, to try and make those operations as minimally invasive as possible so that children don't have to go through open heart surgery.
It's fascinating to find out that last year, of course, British Heart Foundation funded researchers discovered a gene associated with causing a hole in the heart. One remembers Asa Hartford, former West Bromwich Albion and Manchester City footballer who suffered from that, still managed to actually have an extensive footballing career. But it is one of those areas whereby the hole in the heart system can actually be opened up and addressed and put forward.
Yeah, that's one of the conditions that's far more easy to treat, although it does depend on where the hole in the heart is sitting in the heart. And they can also be different sizes. I think a lot of people generally have heard of the fact that someone can have a hole in the heart, but don't necessarily know that it's something that a child can be born with. So the earlier it's detected, then it can be monitored and treated.
The balance between the aorta, the vena cava, and all the other things coming to the fore there. Let's move on to the Bag It, Beat It campaign.
Yes,
because
please.
We've talked about clearly some of the impacts of research, some of the aspects of this whole thing. How can people actually support this with Bag It and Beat It?
Well, Bag It, Beat It's our annual campaign to stock our shops. And what we would like people to do is, if they've got any unwanted goods, to fill a bag and bring it to their local shop. If they don't know where their local British Heart Foundation shop is, they can check our website, which is at bagit.bhf.org.uk, and all bags will be gratefully received. We'll put all that money into research.
And it's also a good way of actually sorting out your clutter, which is
Absolutely.
Always quite good in terms of that. Not only are we looking at clothes, shoes, books, handbags, DVDs, CDs, bric-a-brac, children's toys. Presumably you're looking for the things to be in reasonably good condition, though.
Yes, but we'll take anything. So anything that people don't want, we're quite happy to sift through it at our end. Other people's rubbish is usually other people's treasure, if I've got that saying right. So people shouldn't be worried too much about that side of things. Anything they don't want, we'll take.
This has been, as you rightly say, an annual ongoing thing, and it is having an impact. It is connecting with respect to that whole thing. From the point of view of the work of the British Heart Foundation, I mean, clearly, are there signs of success in terms of how things are going? I mean, presumably the face of the campaign for Bag It and Bin It, Daniel Harris, is a classic case of a success, one might say.
Yes, Daniel's a great success. He's someone that had a hole in the heart, and he was diagnosed quite early, monitored for years, and then he had surgery last year, and he's doing really well now. So, yeah, that shows you just exactly what the research is doing.
Looking at the figures, previous research by the BHF contributed to an 80% fall in the number of children dying from such defects in the last three decades, which can only be a good thing, surely.
Absolutely. And the more money we have, each bag we think raises about £20. We're hoping to get over 1 million bags through our shops this year. And all that money will be going into research and hopefully progressing investigations into this condition.
OK, so let's just summarise the key thing again to actually support this fabulous campaign in terms of the Bag It and Beat It campaign. You're looking for basically the kind of things that you might have tired of, as you rightly said, different sort of house materials and so on, and DVDs and such like. Put it in a bag, take it to your nearest British Heart Foundation store. And is that basically it?
Yep, that's basically it. But if anyone wants any more information, they can check our website. So they just need to go into bagit.bhf.org.uk. Okay.
Maureen, as a senior cardiac nurse, clearly you see both sides of the story in this particular side of things. What was it in particular about this area of medicine that kind of attracted your good self?
I think the most interesting thing is people assume that heart disease only affects adults, whereas it can affect anyone at any age. So it's always important to promote the fact that there's conditions that can happen to children too. Children have less control over what's going on with them, especially if it's something that they're born with. So as much as there's the range of all heart conditions, it's important that people know about this one and that if they've got any symptoms that they get checked out.
And although this is obviously the British Heart Foundation, presumably you would echo the international elements of this whole side of things, because at the end of the day, as being members of the human race, this is something that impacts obviously on an international basis as well.
Yeah, we know that one in three people will die from heart disease one day, and I don't think that's advertised well enough. So from that point of view, it's in everyone's interest to do as much as they can to help us to find out more about all the different heart conditions and to find out basically how to treat them and eventually how to cure them.
Maureen, it's been a delight touching base with a good self and finding out about a very, very worthwhile campaign and re-emphasising the importance of that. We've got two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting and not too stressful, heartfelt discussion with us on the show today?
Yes, I have. Thank you very much.
So can we look forward to hopefully featuring you again in the very near future and keeping us updated with the excellent work of the British Heart Foundation?
Yes, absolutely.
The truth is always out there, sometimes way out there. With the Midweek Drive team on Siren 107.3 FM.
The secret life of cats proved to be so successful that clearly Channel 4 moved into the secret life of dogs, and it's going sensationally well, particularly with reference to the fabulous input that the University of Lincoln has obviously provided into the series, which obviously delves deep into dog behaviour. And coming up on the 2nd of September, it'll be a wonderful line which actually focuses on the growing trend in which canine pharmaceuticals, or indeed treatment for dogs, can also be impactful in all sorts of things. But to discuss the series and her own commitment to this, we're delighted to welcome certified professional clinical animal behaviourist extraordinaire, I added the extraordinaire deliberately, Helen Zulch. How are you, Helen?
Thank you.
Excellent. So I go back to my own studies in Aubrey Manning and ethology and Conrad Lawrence and imprinting and all sorts of things. We've come on such a way since those days when people actually sort of have their animals imprint on themselves, and we seem to have moved into all sorts of understanding with our animal friends.
Yes, I think the field of clinical animal behaviour specifically has moved forward very, very fast over the last couple of decades. Possibly research not keeping up with, the information which is out there and the techniques which we're using, but research also starting to play an ever-widening role in what we're doing in the clinical sphere.
Do series such as this one, which obviously looks to delve into the behaviour of dogs, and it's nice to see we've got some in the background there, which is wonderful, do they kind of trivialise the issue, or do they actually open up a whole new area of exploration?
I think that they can do both. In what I've seen of the way Channel 4 is approaching it, in fact, I think they are not trivialising it. I think they going to a lot of effort to put good science behind what is being done in the field. I think there is always a risk with media looking for viewerships to sensationalise, maybe rather than trivialise, or latch on to the areas which are of greatest interest to people without necessarily looking at the science behind it. But as I say, I think Channel 4 is trying very hard to put forward science-based approaches to things.
Which is always good, because the last thing we really want is Big Brother for Dogs. Although, on the other hand, it might be a possible series. Let's talk a little bit more about your own research in terms of this area. It's an episode which is entitled Difficult Dogs, and it suggests, in essence, that you can actually modify behaviour in dogs by using drugs such as fluoxetine.
What we find that medications such as fluoxetine give us in the field of clinical animal behaviour is an additional tool in our toolbox to change behaviour where it is problematic for animals, for pets or their owners or both. We wouldn't ever say that a medication would be the cure for a behaviour problem, but what it does is the way we usually use it is to assist us to make sufficient changes within the neurobiology of the dog in this case, to enable the dog to more easily learn different behavior patterns so that long-term the problematic behaviors are reduced.
Does this often depend on the species of dog that we're talking about? For instance, I mean, there are certain dogs which automatically have a reputation for being, shall we say, moody or aggressive or somewhat snappy and such like. Or does that make no difference whatsoever in terms of what we actually sort of can use to treat them in many ways?
We take very much an approach within our clinical practice that we treat every dog as an individual. At this point, there is no science that I'm aware of that looks at breed differences in responses to medication, and certainly that wouldn't be something that we would that wouldn't be the approach that we would take within the behavior clinic at Lincoln or within our teaching. We would say we look at the individual dog within the system, the family and home environment system in which it lives, and then we assess, in our opinion, would medication for this individual be the correct response as part of our treatment protocol. But no, it wouldn't be based on a breed decision.
Sometimes the very word or mention of the word pharmaceutical can put people into an apoplexy of rage, because they say, no, it's got to be natural, it's got to be holistic, we've got to work on that basis. Would you say that ultimately what one looks for when we're actually interacting with dogs and canines is some kind of mixture of some possible pharmaceutical elements, treatments, or some which would actually sort of work very much on an organic sense?
I think that the key point that I would be thinking of whenever I was considering a pharmaceutical for a dog would be the dog and people's welfare. And yes, there are very strong opinions on both sides of the spectrum. There are people who use medication fairly frequently because the belief is that most of the problems that they're dealing with have an organic basis which needs a medical treatment. And there are those who believe that we should never use pharmaceuticals in animals for one reason or another. I think we would take the middle ground in that the tool that is going to give the best results, or the tools that are going to give the best results for that individual animal, are what we should be prepared at least to discuss. And we would never insist, when we develop a treatment protocol for an owner, we do it in conjunction with an owner. So if an owner were very opposed to medication, we would look at other options, despite what our opinion might be, and we would look at a solution which fitted an owner's belief patterns as well as what we believed was welfare appropriate for that individual dog. But it would be very much on an individual basis, and we certainly wouldn't negate the use of, we do use other products that are which some people might consider more natural, such as the pheromone products. We certainly don't discount certain of the complementary type products if the evidence is there for their efficacy. So we do use nutritional supplements, some of which are more naturalistic, some of which are more pharmaceutical-like.
Helen, I can certainly see the international ramifications of something like this particular research, because clearly dogs proliferate across the land, and the old cliche goes that they were obviously the first major domesticated animals that humanity actually worked with. From your own perspective, do I detect a slight South African origin to your good background?
Absolutely, yes. I moved to the University of Lincoln from South Africa about 7 years ago.
And in terms of that, obviously the change, the similarities and so on, any particular perspectives or thoughts on the way in which, shall we say, we treat our animals in Britain versus South Africa and so on?
There are differences, yes. I think traditionally, and having not lived there for 7 years, one always has to be careful that things may have changed. Mm-hmm. But I would say that in general, in my my experience with the with working in this field in South Africa, most dogs in South Africa particularly would be more tended to live outdoors, some with more or less access to the house maybe, but during the day particularly would be outdoors, and that's climatic as well as space related and everything else.
Are you suggesting there aren't too many pooper scoopers going around in South Africa? Just a thought.
No, probably not.
It's a different line entirely, and that's for another time. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of September, when the programme obviously is aired, featuring Good Self. Of course, you can also go to dogs.channel4.com to find out more information and obviously download earlier elements of the series. Quick mention, of course, for your colleagues, Professor Daniel Mills and Kirsten Mainz, Professor in Developmental Psychology, who are also obviously part of this whole sequence. But it's fair to say from your own point of view, Helen, you're very much sort of the expertise is focusing on that whole notion of pharmaceuticals and canines and the sort of balance between those two things.
Yes, I think what I'm representing is very much what we as a team in the clinic work with. So it's not specifically my research or my expertise. I would hope to come to be representing the University of Lincoln as a team approach to how we are moving the field of clinical animal behaviour forward.
It's as the best and most profound discoveries often develop through collaboration rather than competition, presumably.
Oh, absolutely. And we do also, wherever possible, collaborate with other organisations, both nationally and internationally.
Indeed. Helen, it's been splendid touching base with your good self today. It's always nice to actually connect with our colleagues up in Risehome and in all sorts of other areas and parts of the university within that. Obviously, the School of Life Sciences, which is where you're based, Lincoln School of Life Sciences. We always throw these two questions as a matter of course on the Midweek Drive. So first of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today?
Oh, absolutely. It's always interesting to talk about the work that we're passionate about.
And can we possibly look upon you to join us again in the not-too-distant future and connect with us again in, who knows, maybe coming down into the studio and actually sort of seeing us on in the show as well?
Yes, we'd love to. Thank you very much.
You might sort of think, it's going to do, it's going to be featuring cattle and all sorts of things. No. There are other ways in which you can actually connect with respect to milk in general, specifically sheep. And we're delighted now to be able to welcome, courtesy and directly of Sarah Gayton, of course, our main Farmers on Film protagonist. We actually can now welcome to the show the fabulous Nuffield New Zealand scholar extraordinaire, Lucy Cruikshank. Lucy, welcome along. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm not sure about the extraordinaire part. I think that title is probably more suitable for Sarah. But thank you for having me.
Well, it's always great. Now, you're from New Zealand, of course, home of the hobbits these days and lots of sheep and a variety of things.
Yes.
Just provide us with some background in terms of what you've been spending the last fortnight doing in the UK.
Sure. So I'm a Nuffield New Zealand scholar, and my special topic this year, I've chosen sheep dairying. So I'm looking at production and marketing globally. And so part of my tour has included 2 weeks in the UK, meeting with some of your most innovative sheep dairy companies.
It's something that I suppose to the uninitiated might catch people by surprise, because they might sort of look at the Lincolnshire long wool and various other breeds of sheep and say, well, of course, they're great for wool. They're great for obviously for non-vegetarians to actually eat lamb chops and various other bits and pieces and so on.
Absolutely.
But perhaps milk is not something that immediately springs to mind. Goat, perhaps, yes, but sheep, less so.
That is true. In our developing countries, well, not our developing countries, but in our Western countries like the US, UK, New Zealand, Australia, milking sheep is a very new phenomena. It's only been occurring for 20, 25 years maximum. But in countries like France and Italy and other European and Middle Eastern countries, they've been milking sheep for thousands of years. It's very common. So it is a new industry, but it's a growing one, and it's a very exciting one.
We certainly must ask our regular gourmet correspondent and Waitrose food editor and general gastronomic expert, William Sitwell, about his views on the whole system. But sheep cheese, sheep milk yoghurt, ice cream, butter producers, there are a whole range of things that are growing. In essence, everything that you get from your standard lactose milk would probably obviously sort of be accompanied by the sheep scenario, with, of course, the growing demand of the lactose intolerant market.
Yes, that's correct. The sheep milk is more similar to human milk in terms of its digestibility, and there seems to be a real affinity for people who are suffering from lactose intolerances to be able to drink and eat sheep's milk products and have no symptoms. So that's an exciting market for sheep milk too.
And yet, given the preponderance of sheep in New Zealand, it's a little bit surprising that actually in New Zealand you've got just 5 established dairy sheep farmers, but they do these things on a pretty large scale, don't they?
Yes, New Zealand has about 30 million sheep, and that's actually far smaller than in years gone by. A lot of people have converted into dairy cow operations. So the dairy sheep opportunity offers a lot for sheep farmers in New Zealand. Sheep that can graze on land that's not suitable for dairy cows, so there's opportunities there. Coupled with that, sheep have less intensity on the land in terms of nitrate levels and nitrate runoff. And generally, it's a third revenue stream for farmers. In the past, we've relied on wool returns and then following that, meat returns, and maybe the next generation is milk returns.
You mentioned at the top of the piece, Sarah Gayton was responsible for putting us together, and obviously her passion for farmers on film very much to the fore within that. Looking at your own research for this, it's very much a global research that you're actually doing, the UK being one of your several stops on the whole routine. You've got Switzerland, Italy, France, the United States, Turkey, Israel, China, Taiwan, Netherlands, Australia and Qatar. quite a wide-ranging selection. I mean, what was the decision in terms of these are the countries I'm going to specify in? Was it primarily countries that had expressed or at least demonstrated some kind of commitment to dairy sheep farming?
Yeah, it was a combination of reasons. I wanted to see some established dairy sheep markets like Israel and Italy, and I wanted to see some more emerging ones like the US, the UK, Australia. And with the Nuffield Network, we have limited time and limited finances, so it was a matter of, I can't do everything, let's just do a splattering of different markets. I also wanted to go up to Taiwan and China because they are potentially some of the biggest markets for New Zealand sheep milk if we grow the industry. So I'll be meeting more on a marketing angle up into those markets. But UK and New Zealand have a lot we can learn off each other, and we can support each other with how to develop from a breeding perspective. Obviously, a lot of the milk that's being produced here in the UK is being used for local consumption, whereas for cheese and for milk and for yogurt, whereas in New Zealand, we're looking more at scaling up into the infant milk formula market into Asia.
Recently in Lincolnshire, obviously, great concern about the Noxon Dairy attempts to obviously introduce very large scale, almost industrial level farming from that point of view. Is there a way in which you can actually look at the sheep dairy industry and say it's it can be intensive, but it can also be ecologically friendly as well? Or is it something where there's still going to be a tension between folk who maintain it's wrong to actually sort of farm out animals like this, it's not good at all?
Well, there is an array of different farmers. Most of the sheep farmers that I've met, you'd call quite, well, in New Zealand terms, they are quite extensive rather than intensive, and a lot of them have only a handful of sheep, or what I'd call a handful of sheep, which is sort of the 250 to 500 sheep mark. I think that the way that the industry is at the moment is very artisan, it's very boutique, and it's very suitable for the ecological spectrum of farming. But it's a balancing act, isn't it? You need to have a viable business model, so it's getting that balance right.
And bottom line, the world does actually need food, otherwise a lot of people in the world will actually cease to be. So it's a critical line from that point of view.
The world certainly needs food, and farmers, you know, they hold that in the palm of their hand. They're powerful people. Quite often they don't realise just how powerful they are, but at the very foundation of our world, we need good quality food, and there's always a market to take different products. It's just about making sure that before you go into production, that you have that market channel developed.
For folk who are listening, as far as Britain's concerned, you can certainly get in touch with sheepmilkuk.co.uk. That's sheepmilkuk.co.uk. There is a British Sheep Dairying Association as well. Just looking towards experiences within the States, I mean, that's a pretty large country, he says fairly self-evidently, going across the landscapes from New York to our regular correspondents in Los Angeles. Any particular areas of the States that you've particularly focused on?
I've only been to New York State and meet with one small organic sheep dairy operator at this stage. I am planning to head to the North American Sheep Dairy Association conference, which is being held in Washington in November. So I'll be meeting with the key sheep dairy producers then. But I believe that most of the dairy sheep farmers are on the in the New York sort of region or in the California region. But again, I've still got a lot of research to do and a lot of travel to do.
I was certainly thinking about putting you in touch with our Los Angeles correspondents, because I feel that what Hollywood has been missing has been more sheep on screen. We've had Babe, Pig in the City. We need more sheep. That's the key.
I love it.
Yeah,
I love sheep. They're a fantastic animal. They have provided so much for us over the years, and we really do need to have them as our national flag.
And in terms of the range, of course, because we've just mentioned obviously the Lincolnshire long wool, you've got a whole stack of other sheep and species and breeds. Is there a particular favourite that you have?
I'm a bit of a fan of the Merino sheep. And the Merino is not a good milker, but I've worked for 6 days on a beautiful organic farm in Abruzzo where they milk Merino sheep. You might be familiar with the New Zealand brand Icebreaker, who do a range of amazing sports apparel and active leisure wear out of New Zealand's fine merino. It doesn't smell. You can wash it. It's beautiful, silky, soft. It's a fantastic fibre. There's also now a meat being marketed out of the merino from New Zealand called Salea Alpine Merino Meat, which chefs are going crazy about. And who would have known, but you can actually milk the Merino too, as I've witnessed in Abruzzo, Italy. So, yeah, the Merino sheep is an incredible animal, and it can live in alpine sort of country, which is not a lot of use for much else. So, fantastic breed. But in terms of milking, around the world, probably 90% of the farms I've been on have used a Friesland or East Frisian breed, sometimes crossed with the French Lacroix breed, and that seems to be a fantastic milky breed of sheep.
And one has to ask the question, Lucy, what was it in particular about this particular project that first appealed to yourself? Just give us a little bit of your backstory in terms of why you decided to follow this through, because I'm sure there's some fascinating research coming out of this.
Well, that's good question. I have my own marketing consultancy company, and I work with food producers to help them grow and export their products. And I've had dealings with a couple of sheep milk farmers in New Zealand who are exporting cheese and other products. And what I noticed is that it was the product, both producers couldn't keep up with demand for their products. And I thought this is actually a really interesting niche food premium product. And so I wanted to do a bit more research into the production around the world. I wanted to see where people were marketing it. That's why I selected a product like sheep milk, because let's face it, both the UK and New Zealand, we can't afford to just mass produce food at minimum margins. We need to be able to produce quality products that we can get a premium for. And sheep milk ticks both those boxes. So that was kind of the reason why I picked sheep milk. Nuffield is an amazing scholarship. And if you get an opportunity, if anyone's listening and they're in the agricultural space from a farming background, apply for a Nuffield scholarship because you can then travel the world, and the Nuffield network opens doors for you all over the world, and you can study your area of agricultural interest, provided that it's for the good of many. So you need to bring that information back and share it with your country and share it with other countries as well. So that's a bit about Nuffield too.
Whilst we've been doing this discussion, I've decided to actually kick against that cliche that men can't multitask. And I've followed you on Twitter because, of course, in terms of actually working through this, you can, of course, follow Lucy on her grand expedition, as defined, Lucy Cruikshank, marketing consultant to great New Zealand food producers, rural girl, foodie, all-round lover of life. And indeed, you can go on to Twitter to actually keep updated with respect to this and simply go to Innovate, that's INNOV and the number 8 AOTEAROA. Not the easiest way to remember to remember.
Sorry,
but no, we could work through. I'm sure you can track Lucy down. It's relatively straightforward. We'll put the link on our Siren FM and Southside web pages as well. Great news, of course. You will be returning to the UK because, as we speak, you're just about to jet off to where, Lucy? Where are you heading off to next?
I am heading off to Israel, of all places. And I am just delighted to hear that there's been a ceasefire.
Well, obviously, if Lucy Cruikshank's going as one of our officially designated Siren FM midweek drivettes, they're going to have to have a ceasefire, for goodness sakes.
That's right. But no, Israel are an incredible country in terms of their agricultural innovation. And they have some extremely sophisticated sheep milking facilities. So I'm being hosted by the Israeli Dairy School. And they've lined up meetings with different farmers, and I'll be working on a kibbutz for the weekend, a sheep milking kibbutz. So I'm pretty excited about the next week.
And there we are. And as this goes out live on the Midweek Drive on Wednesday, you'll probably be sort of in the air, literally flying across the whole sort of sequence. But the great news, of course, is, Lucy, you'll be returning to the UK in November to present your preliminary findings to the British Sheep Dairy Association. Meanwhile, of course, you're going to be all over the globe in various ways. So two final questions. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on the show today?
Yes, very, very good link. Again, thanks to Sarah and the Farmers on Film Network. What Sarah's doing is incredible. Really, really appreciate her networking and her ability to connect producers with consumers.
So hopefully we can connect with you again through your global travels, or certainly when you're back in New Zealand. And Lucy Cruikshank, you will return to the show and keep us updated with the fabulous world of sheep milk production, let's say. I can hardly even sort of get the words out. He's so taken with the whole thing. Will you return, Lucy?
You're doing well, Alex. Thank you.
Okay. Marvellous. Okay, there we are. We're back once again live. A whole heap of good stuff there. You will have encountered the joys of Lucy Cruikshank, Nuffield scholar from New Zealand, discussing, of course, sheep dairies, the secret life of dogs, of course, Helen Zulch, Diane Mather, author and etiquette expert, and, of course, Maureen Talbot, senior cardiac nurse with the British Heart Foundation. Meanwhile, as he actually echoes a whole range of other factors, I bet it's fair to say, Louis Savvy, you never expected to actually talk about sheep milking, did you?
No, but I'm looking forward to the what happens to the sheep afterwards. I'm a big fan of mutton curry and various other things. So when the sheep are worn out. I'm sure there's going to be some good eating.
When last we spoke...
Very sci-fi. Let's not waste any of it, you know.
Absolutely. It's like a boy and his dog writ large.
Exactly.
Sci-fi London continues in every sense of the word, but we were recently at the 72nd World Science Fiction Convention. Absolutely. How did you find it?
I found it very busy. It was a jolly good event, actually. I think it was very well organised. The team behind it were excellent overall. I think everybody that came and joined it, and it's now officially the biggest Worldcon there's ever been in its 72 years. So well done, London.
I like to feel that in many ways the impact of yourself, our colleagues from SFX magazine, Dave Bradley and company, and of course John Jarrold, and let's be honest, the full day's reporting we actually gave from Siren FM and Southside Broadcasting just helped tip that balance, really, Louis.
Well, of course. It wouldn't, without Alex and as you say, Dave Bradley at SFX and everyone else behind the scenes plugging away, it wouldn't have had quite the attention it deserved. And again, I think everyone who was there and helped in any way, you know, made it, again, a very special Worldcon. It was a really good event.
It was. Any questions for Louis, Tarina?
Hi, Louis.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you, very well. I'm glad you're surviving, Alex.
Only just. basically, Louis, I just wondered how you feel. This is just a personal question.
I feel all right,
really.
Actually. I'm all right. thanks for asking this.
That's the third time now.
We like to think so. 13 yeah. minutes past 6 o'clock on a Wednesday evening.
Exactly.
Here on Siren
FM. You're driving home, as you're listening, probably are driving home. I'm sure they feel much better knowing I'm all right.
I hope so.
Louis, I think we'll move away from the Michelle Monroe Tallulah Randall features and just have how is Louis Savvy feeling today?
I can do that once a week for you if you want. I'll blog
genius.
It. Yeah.
What I was going to ask you, Louis, was how you feel about remakes on sci-fi front.
You know, how do I feel about remakes? I've got sort of varying opinions, really. I mean, in an ideal world, I'd like new writers and new directors to get all the chances and have a stab at you know, all the big budgets that are put onto feature films and get a chance to bring us something fresh and new every time. Mm. But in saying that, you know, when things are rebooted or remade well, I think they can be great. I mean, I think Tarkovsky's Solaris is an absolute masterpiece, one of my favourite films, but I also am a huge fan of Soderbergh's version, going back to the original book and trying to bring something slightly fresh to it. So I think there are very good examples of remakes, not just science fiction. I mean, you know, there's been lots of remakes ever since film has been around, you know, and lots of reboots of stories. Wizard of Oz has been maybe, what, 47 times or something ridiculous, you know. But we only remember the one version, you know. We like to foster new talent at the festival. That's what we do. But, you know, when a remake's good, I'm a big fan, just as everybody else is, I think.
Do you feel that remakes are only remembered when they're really bad? Because I've seen a few and I've thought, why didn't you just leave that alone?
Yeah, I mean, there are some films. I mean, I didn't think much of RoboCop. I didn't think much of Total Recall.
No. They were the ones I was thinking of, actually.
Yeah, but I mean, in Planet of the Apes, I think, you know, Tim Burton's version was the nearest to the book, but not a very good film. Mm. And I thought the last two, you know, the Andy Serkis vehicles, I thought were very well done. It was a very good return to that franchise. I'm still waiting for someone one day to go and make the original story, which is, you know, which is a satire of its time, and a fabulous book. I don't know whether it would have much of an audience, given
it's written by a Frenchman, Pierre Boulle. He probably invaded Jersey as a child, pretending to actually sort of attack people.
Who also wrote Bridge on the River Kwai.
Exactly.
You know, which was a fantastic film. You know, so. You know, his stories are solid, and the original Planet of the Apes book, if anyone hasn't read it and doesn't feel the time or the inclination, go and look at Planet of the Apes on YouTube and you'll find an audio version of it on YouTube for free. It's about an hour and a half, 2 hours. It's a cracking little story, really, really cracking little story.
And that's the joy of making sure that, you know, we touch base in every sense. We're looking at the photograph now, Louis, on our Facebook page of yourself posing with, of course, the poster for the 2015 Sci-Fi London scenario. And in keeping with our animal-esque theme on the show today, you've brought us monkeys, of course. We've heard about the secret life of dogs and, of course, sheep milking. I've got a lovely example of a doggy that was one of the winners in the Sci-Fido parade of dogs, sadly, we didn't manage to get our own team of terriers in this year, but I will be, passing on details of Minty Steed to you to actually ensure that we'll have even more Sci-Fidos next year. And in terms of this wonderful, I think it's a pug. I think technically we actually use the term pug. Sci-Fi London, where What If meets WTF? Can I share with the wonders that is Ed Wellman one of the questions and the things we spent many a time actually at Sci-Fi London debating about, which is, should it have the question mark or should it not have the question mark?
Yeah, I am stuck on that one. I like the question mark, but very, let's hear the studio. What do you think?
Poster designer extraordinaire when it comes to the former Lincoln School of Journalism's guest presenter sequence. What's your view on this one?
I don't know, it depends if you consider it to be a sentence or three separate lines. I think it works either way. Where, what, if meets WT? It's kind of a statement more than a question, really, isn't it? So probably not.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think it is.
I would have put dot, dot, dot.
Well, there we are. And then a question possibly on the end of that.
Controversial.
But never mind that. You're looking fabulous, Louis. What a good picture
of you.
Thank you
very much. Yeah. In the orange wig, I think I look pretty good.
Yes, indeed, so you do look good.
I've got
there.
Slightly less beard now. So, if anyone doesn't know what we're talking about, if you Google Sci-Fido, and there's actually the Daily Mail, the Mail Online, I think has got the best coverage from last year's dog show. There's about 100 pictures on there of a dog dressed as Darth Vader. We had a Marilyn, Superman, Leilu Dallas from The Fifth Element, which is what we use for our poster. Artwork for the ad artwork in the WorldCom book. And this year, the winner was a Tuscan Raider. We had a little terrier who took part last year and came dressed as K-9 from Doctor Who.
I think we can just see that now. Yes.
Yeah. And, I mean, they're great. They really go to town on their costumes. This year, he was a Tuscan Raider. So, if you have a look at, I think it's maybe on our website, certainly on our Facebook page.
It certainly is there. We're a little bit uncertain about Bunny Galore, who, I mean, that's either one heck of a makeup job, but something completely in place there, exactly.
Well, let's keep the animal motif running. We've had dogs, and now we've got rabbits. So, but a lovely Bunny Galore. She was fantastic as our host, and hopefully she'll be back with us next year doing more.
Okay,
so.
Louis, give us some dates. Where are we for 2015? Is it May?
I can't tell you yet. We haven't made a decision on that.
Listen, Louis, I can reveal something now. It's just been made today. The decision has been confirmed. The Sci-Fi Symposium, otherwise known as Telefantasy and British Culture, Telefantasy and Culture, will be taking place, hopefully with your good self, in Lincoln, just ahead of Lincoln Inspire next year, on Wednesday, May the 6th.
Fantastic. Yep. Well, I'll certainly be there, unless we're clashing, of course. But now I know your date.
Well, this is it.
I'll make sure that we're not a direct clash.
Well, what I thought, because normally Sci-Fi London wraps up on the bank holiday, which of course was Star Wars Day, May the 4th be with you. So that was also part of the strategy. I thought, well, if we go May the 6th, then that should be okay.
Sounds like a
sound
plan.
So there we go. And how is the Kent countryside, Louis? Because you are a man on vacation at present.
I am on vacation with my three kids. We're down near Dymchurch on the lovely Kent coast. And today it was sunny and we actually got to play on the beach today. So
Excellent. So
very good. Yep. Well, I was looking out to think, reading some script ideas. We're developing along with Wild Seed Studios, I think the Summer of Sci-Fi at the moment. If you do a search for hash Summer of Sci-Fi, you'll find our 48-hour films are being posted on their YouTube channel. But we just interviewed about 20 of the teams, and they've pitched feature film ideas. We're going to pick five of them at the end of this month and put them in development over the next 3 months. And at Christmas, we'll decide which one we love the best. And then we'll pick it, write a script, make it, start shooting hopefully in the spring.
And that's the kind of positivity that the world needs more of.
Yeah, and it won't be a remake, that's for sure. It'll be an original an original British science fiction film.
Ed, last two questions for Louis Savvy, please.
Louis, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us here at Siren FM today?
It's always interesting.
Indeed it is. Thank you. And can we look forward to connecting with you again before too much longer?
Absolutely.